This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Gary Ashbeck, a member of Jonah House, the faith-based community in Baltimore, started by Liz McAllister and Phil Berrigan, which has inspired a generation of activists to engage in civil disobedience. Ashbeck is also a member of Military Families Speak Out, and most recently of Witness Against Torture, a new group of two dozen U.S. citizens, now I'm sure more, but two dozen U.S. citizens who went down to Cuba last December to march to Guantanamo and protest the internment camp there. Gary Ashbeck, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much.
Tell me about this Witness Against Torture group. How did it get started? How did you get involved in it?
Well, as being from Jonah House and a group of people of the Catholic Worker Movement, and involved in a lot of different issues, we started trying to figure out, well, what do we do about this issue? And after a period of meeting for about 7 months, we came up with, let's go down there. And so 25 of us went down there and did the trip. And since then, the group has sort of blossomed into really a coalition of a lot of different organizations that we're working with that have joined on with us. And, you know, our mailing list is actually quite huge now.
Take me to Cuba on that trip. Americans aren't supposed to be allowed to get to Cuba unless you're a reporter or a medical person. I think, how'd you get there in the first place?
We just went down there. We had to fly through a third country to get there.
But so did you go through Mexico?
Some of us went through the Bahamas, and some of us went through Dominican Republic.
And when you got to Cuba, you engaged in a march. Where were you marching from? How long was the march? What was that like?
We marched from Santiago to Guantanamo Bay, just outside the militarized zone, which is just outside of the city of Guantanamo. And it was about 70 miles, if I remember correctly, and it took us probably about 4 or 5 days.
Was it hot?
It was very hot, and it was a bit chilly at night. One doesn't expect that. A lot of us were pretty ill-prepared for that. And it was the direct sun, but also just walking through the hillsides and meeting the people that were there.
Well, what reaction were you getting from the Cuban people as you were walking by?
First of all, Cubans love Americans that come down there because they know that you're breaking the law. And so they're all like very excited about that. And then they love activists as well, because for them, the revolution is still alive and well. So when they found out we were U.S. activists that came down there, you know, protesting the United States, it was like we were the Beatles. It's pretty cool.
Wow, celebrities in Cuba. And then how close did you get to the base itself, and what happened when you got there?
We were a few kilometers away. There's the Guantanamo Bay Naval Station is surrounded by this large fence and then a minefield. And then there's the Cuban militarized zone around that to isolate it. And it's isolated to keep people from leaving the base to possibly cause mayhem in Cuba, and then also to prevent Cubans from going there and trying to start something. It's obviously an area of friction, and so there's a lot of fear around, so they just want to isolate it completely. And so we were allowed up to the militarized point that the Cubans had set up, but they had also allowed us a symbolic crossing of that point to show that they were indeed in solidarity with us. But because we weren't being allowed by the United States, we couldn't go any further.
And did you have contact then with U.S. military representatives at Guantanamo?
We started making regular phone calls. Once we got to there, my first phone call was to the White House, where I was told by the White House staff that President Bush does not have permission to give us permission to go onto a military installation, even though he's the commander-in-chief of the military.
How did that phone call work? You call the White House switchboard, and then you got connected to someone?
I called, and then they passed me off to another staff person from the switchboard, and that's when they explained that to me. And they said, you should call the Pentagon. So then I called the Pentagon, and they said, well, you should call Central Command, and they gave me another number. And they said, well, that falls under Southern Command, so you need to call Southern Command. And then Southern Command says, oh, you need to talk to the base. And they transfer me over to the base. And the base immediately on the switchboard is like, you need to talk with public affairs. And then they'd cut us off.
And they knew you were coming, though. They'd seen the reports?
They knew we were... Once we hit Santiago, they knew we were coming. In fact, the State Department and the base both had to issue statements about that.
And did you engage in a fast there out front? What happened?
Once we got to the base, we engaged in a fast and a round-the-clock vigil, prayer vigil and remembrance vigil, reading the stories of the people that are being held there, which really was just, I mean, kilometers, just a hillside over from where we were.
Well, tell me about some of those stories, because we hear conflicting things in the United States about Guantanamo and the conditions there. There was a recent New York Times Magazine story that was saying that the commander there was trying to improve things and the prisoners were double-dealing him. And then, of course, there's Rush Limbaugh, who thought all the torture down there was just a frat boy prank. So what accounts did you get? What's the truth about Guantanamo?
Amnesty International on their website has a whole bunch of articles about how people have gotten down there and how they're being treated. And then there... And it really brings up really two aspects of all of our military prisons that were around the world, which now I just read this morning in the newspapers, now 14,000 detainees that we have, which, you know, detainees is a sanitized word. They're prisoners, really.
I mean, this is the gulag that Amnesty International talked about and got in so much trouble for calling it a gulag.
It is.
How else do you describe 14,000 prisoners held from Iraq to Cuba to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, secret prisons around the world. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. My guest today is Gary Ashbeck, a member of Witness Against Torture, a new group that is casting a spotlight on Guantanamo. And he went with a group of two dozen other members of faith-based communities here in the United States to protest conditions in Guantanamo back in December. Are you guys being prosecuted for having gone there?
We have received, well, some of the members of our group have received initial letters about this, and that's actually a rather funny story because it shows how poor their intelligence really is. We all signed these little forms when we got in the United States that said we were in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And so that was all entered in, it was all there, and then they only sent half of us letters.
Now, you had to sign these forms when you came back into the United States?
Yeah, the declaration form, you have to say
where
you... The
customs declaration.
Yeah, you have to write that down. And we all declared that we had been down to Cuba, and half of us were sent letters. And then some people who had not gone on the trip with us, but we knew, had gotten letters as well.
What did the letters say? What did the letters say, yeah?
The letters stated that we were... in violation, or they were being investigated and being violation of this travel restriction, and that they were looking at assessing a fine, and that we needed to fill out a questionnaire saying, you know, how much money we spent, who we had contact with, and things like that.
Do you think members of the group are going to be prosecuted, or is this just kind of petty harassment?
What I'm hearing is it's like a five-year process that we did that, and if we had not submitted anything to that, then it would immediately go to a collections agency, they would assess a fine, and then we'd have to pay it. This way, we're challenging it. We sent them back a report, and we didn't fill out the questions they were asking, which is how much was spent, you know, who did we have contact with in Cuba, things like that. We just sent our group statement that we had given them before anyway, stating why we had gone down there and that this was a First Amendment right, that we would, you know, we are allowed to go down there and follow, you know, and that's not a freedom of speech First Amendment right. You know, this is our religious call to visit prisoners. As Christians, we are to do that. And, you know, freedom of speech is one thing, but to be allowed to practice our faith is another.
The United States is a predominantly Christian country, and yet a large percentage of the American people seem to be in favor of these torture policies that the Bush administration has been promulgating and executing. Why do you think that is?
I've noticed that Christianity in this nation is very different than it is from around the world. And I think that was one of the biggest things that was a compliment to the trip is the fact that there were so many people around the world who were recognizing that this is not the form of Christianity that was being exported from this nation, which is really one that is in cahoots with the state.
Bush right now is trying to get permission from Congress to essentially excuse him and his CIA professionals, as he calls them, from the restrictions of the Geneva Conventions, which they've been violating anyway. What do you make of that?
Well, I find it interesting. He's been referring to the Geneva Conventions as vague. So that I find just, first of all, pretty interesting.
Outrages upon human dignity, he says, is a vague clause, even when it goes on to, I think it says, including degrading and humiliating treatment or something along those lines.
But, you know, they keep bringing up the word security, and this has been the mantra we've heard since September 11th, that all that we need to be safer and we need to be more secure and we need to find out information from people. And that's where it starts breaking down, is the fact is we are not getting information. We are not getting information from people that are being held there. And it's not how you don't get it from the interrogation practices that they are advocating for. You do not get information that is valuable.
That's not what Bush says, though. He said they needed to waterboard. He didn't use the words, but they needed to use these tough techniques against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was one of the chief al-Qaeda guys and so-called mastermind of 9/11, to get the guy to squeal. You don't think that's true?
I don't believe that's true at all. And if you talk with intelligence people that gather this stuff, they will say that you basically just get a whole bunch of information, and because of the sheer volume of it, you have nothing that's really usable, because you either the person has no information giving a whole bunch of stuff, or they have the information, might not be giving you that information. They might be, but who knows, because they gave you a whole bunch of information.
And it's such an immoral thing to do in any event. And then the Colin Powell argument or the John McCain argument is that it puts our troops in jeopardy if we're going to violate Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, and any other country that grabs a U.S. soldier will have permission to do that as well. The other thing about Common Article 3 is the Supreme Court upheld it in June, and the Bush administration doesn't want to follow the Supreme Court. Actually, Bush himself said, unfortunately, the Supreme Court ruled that he had to obey the Geneva Conventions. That was in particular related to the issue of military tribunals. There are a lot of people there at Guantanamo who have been determined not to be terrorists, and yet they've been languishing there for 3 years now or more. Why can't those people be free, and what are you trying to do, Gary Ashbeck, with Witness Against Torture to try to help those people?
This is actually one of those strange little twists of fate, because they're concerned that some of these people have been grabbed, like when they're outside. They've been living in like Britain, for instance, but were Libyan citizens. And when they've, you know, been living there and now can't go back there, they would have to go back to their nation of citizenship, which would be Libya, where in some people's situations, in a lot of these different countries, would be killed or tortured. And so it's better to hold them in our prisons than going there.
So you think some of them might actually be better off there than going back to Egypt to be tortured?
Well, that's what they're claiming.
There's a ring of truth to part of that, though.
I think there's a ring of truth of part of that, but I think another part of it is, well, really the basic idea of why they're being held there in the first place, and that is to create fear in a population. And if it's outwardly put out that there are people that are innocent there but are still holding on to them, and everybody in the administration now is just wringing their hands saying, well, there's nothing we can do, but we as a wonderful, God-fearing nation cannot possibly send them back, you know, we get all the sentimentality in this country and all the fear in the other countries, you know, that's really the goal. So we have decided that we're going to try heading that off. And right now we're in the process of looking at inviting those people that are freed, if they do want to do this, to come to the United States, and we will open homes for them and start working on ways of working with the traumas that they've gotten from the ill treatment.
This is
like
your organization, Witness Against Torture, or is it another organization?
This is Witness Against Torture, and we're working with a few other organizations, including Torture Task, which is a torture abolitionist survivors and support coalition, which is a group of torture survivors that are looking to end torture as well. And they have these communities which are founded by torture survivors to help other people go through torture, because it really is such a detrimental thing that it's hard for a person to function in society after they've gone through that.
Gary Ashbeck, forgive me, but I can't for the life of me imagine that George W. Bush or Donald Rumsfeld or Dick Cheney or Alberto Gonzalez are going to want people who they held illegally in Guantanamo in horrible conditions for years on end to come and live in the United States.
Well, there's two things I would say. First of all, it's precedent. When we were holding Haitians down there, in the end, many of those Haitians were invited here into the United States. And that was the original prison was being used to hold Haitians. And Number two, what are they doing? They're doing nothing. They're wringing their hands. They're saying there's nothing we can do. We want to keep them safe.
So you're we're calling bluff on
we're
that.
Giving, well, we're giving them an option. And there are a lot of people are willing to stand up for that as well.
Well, I wish you luck on that. Can we talk about the Iraq War a little bit? Your brother, I read, went to Iraq at the same time that you were protesting the Iraq War. That must have been a peculiar situation to find yourself in.
It was probably more peculiar that I'd actually gone there before he had gone there.
When were you there?
I was there in, oh gosh, when was that?
This was before the war.
It was just before the war. It was 2002, summer of 2002 I was down there.
And what were the conditions that you found when you got there?
What I'm hearing, better than what they are now.
Really?
I mean, they had functioning electricity for the most part. There were some blackouts. But for the most part, we had electricity for most of the time I was there. We had traveled through to Mosul and also Basra as well, and had gone through the no-fly zones and visited with people down there. Went through hospitals of children that were dying of leukemia and things like that.
So you saw the effect of sanctions, the brutal effect of sanctions,
and as well as depleted uranium. And talk with people on the streets who were very supportive of us as people and said, but your government, why do they continue to do this and why are they threatening further harm on us?
Did they know the war was coming, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, bombing had been escalating, of what I hear, since 2001. While we were there, air raid sirens when we were in Basra and Mosul were going off pretty regularly. And for us, it was like we were freaking out, trying to jump on the table, and everybody else is just carrying on because they've been living with that for 11 years.
Now, you've been a peace activist for some time, and the lead up to the Iraq War was a time of great energy in the peace movement here in the United States, and when we had those 10, 11, or 12 million people protesting all at once on the same day, it looked like the world peace movement was going to stop this war, and yet that didn't happen. Was that terribly dispiriting for you too? Discouraging, paralytic to some extent for a lot of people in the peace movement?
I think it was discouraging, but I think what was probably more discouraging is the fact that it did paralyze some people and that we really haven't seen the numbers since then, even with all of the very heinous things that have been coming out.
Well,
and
what would
more
you
of the support, really, the public support against the war.
But it's understandable in a way. I mean, there we had probably the biggest peace protest ever in the history of the world as far as a coordinated international peace action, and it didn't work. So how do you tell people who are going to interpret that as failure that somehow they can, make change? I mean, how do you speak to them? I'm speaking with Gary Ashbeck. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Gary's been a longtime activist. He was an SOA Watch. He's with Military Families Speak Out. He's at Jonah House in Baltimore, which is the faith-inspired civil disobedience resistance community. He's with Witness Against Torture, was down in Cuba. What do you tell people about the efficacy of peace activism if that momentous action did nothing?
Well, if you look at history, I mean, it's really that type of movement, the people's movements like that, are what have changed things. We just can't give up. What I would recommend is up the ante. If you haven't gone to a protest, go to a protest. Start going to protests. If you haven't been writing letters, write some letters. I mean, start going up further, and maybe some people who have been doing a lot of these protests and stuff, maybe this is the time they want to start sitting in Herb Kohl's office, or things like that.
You've upped the ante many times in your life. How many times have you been arrested?
Oh, gosh, I don't know, and I really don't want, I don't want to brag about that.
But it's more than a handful. It's dozens, or is it less than 10? Bigger than a bread box. What is it?
It's over 10.
Okay, there you go. And were you ever brutalized, either behind bars or by people who were arresting you?
I think any time you're put in a situation like that, you're brutalized. I think people don't realize that our prisons and jails is, in fact, low-level torture. And when I came out, I did 6 months once for School of the Americas. When I came out, it was tremendously hard. And at certain points, I was dealing with panic attacks when I was in close confined spaces. When you're in jail and the door shuts and you get that clang of metal and there's no getting out, you can justify it. But when you're outside and you get that same feeling in you of that clang of the metal and you're outside, what do you do with that? And so that's one of the things that you really work with.
I can't imagine what the clang of that metal would be. I've never been to jail. Some of my heroes have been. Phil Berrigan, who is one of the founders of Jonah House. And Sam Day, who was an editor at the Progressive magazine for years and then one of the founders of Nukewatch, and Bonnie Erfer, who's been up at Nukewatch for years. All of them have spent many years behind bars and have been arrested dozens of times. But, I mean, I will at one point, I hope, join you there. What do you tell people who've never engaged in civil disobedience, if that's the term, to take that step?
Well, you bring up that term. Civil disobedience, it's sort of the classic example of that, is like what Martin Luther King and company were doing with, in general, the civil rights movement with sit-ins and lunch counters, because they were legally not allowed to do that and things like that. And right now, like, there is no, like, there is a law against going on to Fort Benning, but it's not because we want to go on to Fort Benning.
School of the Americas down in Georgia.
Yeah.
And School of the Americas is the military organization that has trained torturers and dictators throughout Latin America and even kindly translated a torture manual into Spanish in the 1980s, infamously. So there have been protests now more than 10 years, right, down at Fort Benning School of the Americas, getting as many as 10,000 or more people to go down there. What month does it happen?
November. It's coming up in, just before Thanksgiving.
Okay. And so you're making a comparison or contrast between traditional Martin Luther King, Gandhi civil disobedience and something else?
Yeah, what really is called civil resistance, that there is no specific law that you think is unjust, but a system that is unjust. And in some cases, like for instance with nuclear weapons and work against nuclear weapons, that it in fact is that if you are trying to prevent nuclear weapons from being deployed or built, that is actually upholding the law, because the U.S. Constitution has in it that our treaties are the highest form of law in the land, and we have signed treaties saying that we are getting rid of them, or these weapons we don't do. Even the U.N. Charter says we can't target civilians and nuclear weapons target civilians. So that is a way that really not only are you acting against what the government is doing, but you're actually upholding their own law.
And occasionally, will a judge side with you on your interpretation of Article 6 of the Constitution, which says treaties are the supreme law of the land, or do you usually, and people you associate with, usually get shot down on that?
We have better luck with the local judges that have more of an understanding of the law than federally appointed judges who can move up based on their decisions.
Now, I read you had protested in front of the White House sometime in the last year or so, and you were arrested for that, and you got acquitted. What was that action?
A group of us with military families speak out had decided to lay down on the anniversary of, on the day that 2,000 soldiers had died in Iraq, as if we were laying in a cemetery in front of the White House. And we were charged with demonstrating without a permit, but really we should have been charged with because right in front of the White House, you are not allowed to hold. Well, you're technically not allowed to hold a sign or a demonstration, because that's the picture postcard zone. But really,
is that what they call it?
That's what they call it. But the reality of it is, we call it no standing in front of the White House with a radical message. Because if you're holding the flag or a sign that says God bless America, the police don't even come up to you.
So they discriminate against people on the basis of content, which is supposed to be unconstitutional as far as the First Amendment goes.
Yes.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Gary Ashbeck, a member of Military Families Speak Out, a member of Jonah House, the faith-based civil resistance movement in Baltimore, and a member of Witness Against Torture. This Iraq war is still going on. We're beyond 2,000 dead now. That was the action you protested against last year, almost at this time. We're beyond 2,500. We are right around 2,700.
Yeah.
How many U.S. soldiers are going to have to die before the United States gets out there? 20,000 U.S. soldiers wounded, too. And Iraqi civilians who were supposed to be liberated by George W. Bush have died at astronomical numbers, really, 40,000 to upwards of 140,000. What's it going to take to get us out of there?
I think it's also important to note, when we're talking about casualty rates, is the fact that these 20,000 people that are injured are not just, they weren't shot in the butt or things like that. These are people, for the most part, that are missing limbs. And it's because of the body armor they're wearing now that protects their major organs so they can live through major trauma. but are really subject to really completely life-altering things. So really, like, the casualty rate could be around, you know, 15,000 if it wasn't for such protective measures. And then some of the parents that I have met of soldiers who have lost their legs and stuff like that, and are also dealing with the psychological trauma, which is all the other soldiers that are coming back. You know, the reality is, you know, should they have died on the field there? Maybe it would be better if they had. Mm. I mean, that's a hard statement to hear a mother say, and I've been to Walter Reed, and I've heard these mothers say that.
Mm. What's Walter Reed like? I've never been there.
I don't know how to describe it. There's a lot of spirit. I would say that the staff there is very good about, you know, trying to be very helpful. But there is just so much reminder of the war there. I mean, so many loss of limbs, so much major trauma to people's bodies. It's hard to walk through those and see that. And I think for me, I didn't do enough.
Hmm. Well, we all need to do more. But one thing that I have sometimes difficulty with is just engaging in debate or conversation with people who don't agree with me on this. And they say, these are well-meaning people. These aren't, you know, neocon hawks who don't give a damn about either U.S. soldiers or Iraqi civilians. They say, look, there's a mess over there. The United States created the mess. We have an obligation to clean up the mess. And if we leave now, it's going to get worse. How do you answer that?
It's a lot of things, but I think that it's the idea that by starting to say we have an obligation to do this or that we're the ones to do it is saying the Iraqi people are incapable of doing that. And really, that's a form of racism that we need to recognize, that they are, in fact, very capable people. In fact, they're more highly educated than we are, but we fail to remember that. But I think it's also important to say that we can still support them. We just don't need to be over there brutalizing. And really, our presence in Iraq is inviting outside forces to come in because they can fight us.
And you're not worried at all that if the United States left, the Civil War would rage even more ferociously and more innocent people would die?
You know, it's probably not going to end the conflict. I think that in a certain case, there's other ways. I look at Milosevic, where the United States government was in fact responsible for teaching Gene Sharp, who was a teacher of nonviolence, was into like sit-ins and stuff like that, was actually able to help teach a population there to overthrow someone who we all call Hitler now, just like we demonize everyone, like Saddam is a Hitler.
America's got a spot for demons, foreign demons.
And there is ways of doing this, but you know, it's less money involved than sending over a book than there is dropping $100,000 bombs on people. Hmm.
Thanks for being my guest today. I've been speaking with Gary Ashbeck, who is with Jonah House in Baltimore. He's with Military Families Speak Out. He's with this new group, Witness Against Torture, that is trying to flash a spotlight on Guantanamo and give sanctuary to people who've been at Guantanamo and are viewed not as a threat. How should people interested in doing some of this work contact you or some of these organizations?
People can reach Witness Against Torture by going on the web to witnesstorture.org.
Gary, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.